This episode of HBR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HBR15. That's HBR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi folks, this is Ken and you're listening to Hacker Public Radio. Today is special. Tradition dictates that I do a show, and yes, today's show is Hacker Public Radio episode 2000 and okay, it's actually 2300, including the Today with the Techie shows, but a tradition is a tradition. Anyway, deciding on what we would do to mark the occasion, I have decided to honour the most dedicated companion of HBR down through the years. Someone who has been there with every host, every contributor, every listener who's thought of recording a show. Yes, folks, it's our old nemesis, procrastination. So, if you ever end up volunteering to do the administration here in HPR, every so often you'll get contacted with a message along the lines of, you know, I was thinking of doing a show on a very interesting topic and it might turn out to be a series. This has happened so often down through the years, even in the interview with Droops, he mentioned it, that there's a motto here, it's not a show until it's on the server. So we don't actually care. All it takes for a show to be accepted by HBR is two people to find it interesting, and as you know, Dave and I find all shows interesting, so including yourself, that's one over the quota. So we tracked down the worst possible procrastinator on the network, and this person is regularly on social media, IRC, his own blog, and even on the New Year's show itself, telling everybody what shows they intend to do next year and why they didn't do the show, blah, 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 blah. So I'll read out an email verbatim, and I want you to pay particular attention to the date that it was sent.
Forwarded message, subject, TWAT, satellite communications date, due, 13 Dec 2005, 12054 plus 0100. Hi, Droops. I heard your call for content, and I'd like to send you some shows. I don't have a lot of spare time with work and a young family, so I can't do a regular show, but I can send you a series on a topic. I was thinking of doing a series on satellite communications.
Wow. So, folks, that was 11 years ago. 13th of December 2005. So who was this person? Who do we need to track down for this? Yes, no other than my good self. Yes, I told Droops I would send in a show, and did I ever? No. And so therefore, for episode 2000, to mark the occasion, I have recorded this show. And to be honest, I have been jinxed with this. There's two aspects to it. One is, when I'm researching the topic, give you some background. When I joined, when I came over to the Netherlands, the first job I got was in a satellite ISP. We were resellers to, we were providing the uplink for other satellite ISPs. At the time, there was very little broadband, even in the Netherlands, which was the highest, one of the highest penetrations of broadband in the world. There was only about 5% of people had broadband. Since then, DSL came along and cable networks got their act together and stuff. But at the time, it was a viable alternative. I was actually working on content distribution. I was actually a Windows admin back then. Anyway, it was actually there that I got my first introduction to Linux, because the whole system was based on Linux. written in Perl, actually, believe it or not. So what would happen is you as an end customer have a satellite card in your computer or a satellite router, and that's got a MAC address. And it listens to an incoming signal from a satellite. We'll talk more about that in a minute. And it listens for the stuff destined for its MAC address. Now, that might come from a point-to-point connection, so something only for that MAC address, or it might be for something that it is subscribed to on a multicast network. So it has joined a group, or we've joined it to a group, and we're sending it out. So that for the group transmission, say at the time a big thing was digital cinema, and the question was, how are we going to send down those files? And the idea was that there would be satellite dishes in all cinemas. You go into a multicast group and all the cinemas would receive the movie at the same time. So that was pretty cool. But satellite internet continues to be an extension, especially the DVB standard, which is the digital video broadcasting standard, which is what Sky and, you know, a lot of the satellite TV providers, at least here in Europe, use. I know in the US they use something similar, and it allows data packets to be sent down there. So what you would do is on your dial-up modem, you get a free dial-up disk at the time from AOL or whatever. You put it into your computer, you use your modem, and you would connect to the internet over that. And usually these were free phone services, and you'd be able to use them for a period of time. Then you would start a GRE tunnel, which would be a VPN connection, and we didn't encrypt the connection or anything, but all it allowed us to do was do an IP connection over the internet. And this is a basic Windows package for business. And that would connect to our platform, and then you would now be routing all your packets to our uplink station. So you log in, login password, and we would have your MAC address of your DVB card. You would send a request, www.altavista at the time, and the request would go to AltaVista, be sent over the GRE tunnel to us. We would proxy it out to AltaVista. We would get a reply back, and instead of sending it back down to you on IP tables, simply sent it over to the address of the router. The router would take it and put it into a Tandberg, which was multiplexer, and it would get sent out to the satellite. The satellite would broadcast it, send it down to everybody. Basically, everybody else would ignore it. You were tuned in on that satellite and that frequency, and your MAC address would listen to that, and it would take the packets in. The TCP/IP being a layered level, the layers underneath are stripped off and just passed up. And all that the browser knows is that it sent a request with this window, with this ID, and it got a reply back from this ID, and it had no understanding of what happened underneath, and it didn't care. So it actually works very well, because it's you got fairly high band, if you're high bandwidth throughput rates, so long as there was it wouldn't be great for lag, because, you know, you click a button and it takes half a second for it to go out to the satellites and back. So, you know, that's not very good for games. But if you're starting a download of a movie or something, you know, that half a second that comes down at the time, like, people were running really slow connections, half a meg connections, if they were lucky you get 23 megabits per second if the satellite was empty. What shot it in the foot was the rollout of broadband and people trying to make profit, because this is very expensive. It's very expensive to host. You have to pay the uplink provider, and also you had to basically, everybody wanted to use the system at the same time, which meant it was the contention ratios were very, very high, and you send a request and you only get a small piece of the bandwidth. So that's that. So let's first of all talk about the basics here. First of all, what is an orbit? We need to talk about satellites orbiting the planet. So first of all, what an orbit is. So if you take a football and you kick it, doesn't matter if it's a round one or a funny shaped one, it will orbit the planet and then fall back to Earth. If you roll it along the ground, it doesn't. But if you throw it, it has a forward momentum, and then eventually it will fall down. So if you have a better football player and they kick the ball further, or throw the ball if you're an American football player, it will go further before it falls down. So it has a bigger orbit than the other one. The fact that it hits the Earth doesn't actually matter as such from the point of view of orbits. It just happens. So this guy called Isaac Newton, you might have heard of him, had this idea that thought experiment, so that you built a tower anywhere on the Earth. It doesn't matter. Let's say we go up to Mount Everest, the top of Mount Everest, and we carry with us a gun, and we fire that gun, and we fire it in any direction, doesn't matter. What happens is that bullet goes out, keeps going firing. It's going forward, and it continues to go forward, but eventually gravity catches it and it goes down. But if you were going, you fired a gun, and maybe it had a little missile inside it and had its own little engine and started going forward faster and faster and faster, the rate at which it falls would eventually get to be the same circumference as the Earth. Then you had an even faster one, more powerful gun, and you fired it off. Then it would actually fire straight off into space. At a particular point in time, it's going so fast that the effect of gravity gets less and less and less and less, so it curves down a little bit, but eventually heads off into space where the Earth's gravity ceases to have an effect on it. But it's that happy little interesting one in between that is the orbit one. So what we think of as an orbit, where it goes round and round and round and round. And the key part of that is basically you're falling the whole time. Sometimes it might think, you know, you think of an orbit as going around the Earth. Just go turn your mind 90 degrees and imagine you falling straight off Mount Everest. No, that doesn't actually make any sense. But anyway, in order to orbit, you need to be going at a particular speed. So if you're like in the International Space Station, for instance, so let's break down these orbits first. You have no orbit, which is like your football thing. Suborbital trajectories, which is like is where you basically go up for a good bit and then come down without actually going around the Earth. The trajectory intersects the atmosphere so that it does not complete one orbital revolution. Orbital trajectories, which are the ones that we were talking about, and escape trajectories, where you orbit and you leave the planet. Or body, or whatever, moon, or whatever you happen to be orbiting at this point in time, for the purpose of, unless HPR has a listenership that I'm not aware of, we're talking about people on the planet Earth at the moment. So a lot of this information is coming from Wikipedia, and one of the main reasons why I had so much trouble doing this show is that it is such an interesting topic for me. I cannot stop clicking links and stuff, so I've had to be really focused for the last 3 days, because I know this is coming up and this is the last time I'm going to get a chance to record it. I'm doing a second part to this, which will be I'm going to take the recorder here and just head straight up onto the roof. I'm going to press pause, walk up on the roof, and then continue recording this thing. So hopefully it'll get submitted automatically after I'm done that. Anyway, then where are we? Yes, orbital position. It's worth noting that, so when you fire off a rocket, first of all, it goes vertically just to get out of the atmosphere. But once it's gone up enough, it starts tilting and then tilting into orbits. So once in orbit, to keep their speed in the atmosphere, an elliptical orbit dips into the dense air. The object will lose speed and re-enter. Occasionally, a spacecraft will intentionally intercept the atmosphere, and commonly referred to as an aerobraking maneuver. So that's how they slow down spaceships coming in. But basically, they something like the International Space Station, as it rotates, it's 340 kilometers above Earth, that loses 90 meters a day. So 90 meters a day, like size of a football pitch, I guess. Having no idea how long a football pitch is. Yeah, okay, well, whatever. So that occasionally has to fire its thrusters, onboard engines, in order to raise it above. bring it to a higher orbit, and when it's refueled or refueling station comes, they will fire their rockets and give it a bit of a bump to get it even higher into the give it a higher orbit. So there are lots of ways of defining orbits, and if there was only somebody with a, I don't know, maybe a Scottish accent who perhaps is professional in dealing with the night sky and all of this stuff, could talk to us about orbits and other cool things that I was talking about. sorry, a bit of a flu. Anyway, types of orbits. So they're basically the type of orbit that you pick is dependent really on what you want the satellite to do. So here are some of the classifications. Eccentric classification, so it's based on what the orbit. An altitude classification, based on how high they are, and that's the most common one. Inclination classification, based on the rotation above the equator, or you know, on or above the equator. Eccentricity, which is based on their path, is it circular or elliptical or like hyper-elliptical or whatever. And synchronicity, so based on how often they rotate. So often you'll have a combination of several of these describing a particular satellite that it's in, one or the other. So let's go through the altitude ones, which are the most important ones, I think. By far, most of the satellites are in low Earth orbit, or LEO, as they call it. And that goes from 0 to 2,000 kilometers. So 1,240 miles. So it starts at sea level, and the first band is to the maximum height that a self-propelled jet aircraft has ever gone, which was set in 1977. And that is 37.6 kilometers or 23.4 miles. Now, the first artificial satellite was Sputnik 1, and that got up to 215 kilometers, which is 133.6 miles. Think about this, that when you're thinking about these, how far the satellites are, like low Earth orbit satellites are really not that far away at all. As I said before, 340 kilometers is where the International Space Station is, 211 miles. Mir used to be at 390 kilometers, 242. The Hubble Space Telescope is up there at 595 kilometers, which is 369 miles. And the reason for the Hubble telescope being up there is because, and again got distracted with this one, because our atmosphere filters out an awful lot of the wavelengths. So only like we see sunlight and radio signals are basically all that comes through the atmosphere. So if you want to examine any other of the wavelengths, electromagnetic spectrum outside of that, then you got to get your satellite up, or your telescope up into space. So that's why that has been able to give such fantastic images, because it's not limited by the relatively small amount of the spectrum that we can see. Again, no expert on this, it's just, this pretty much is just me getting very interested in this topic. So this is, you can classify this whole topic as Ken's wish list for stuff, if anyone knows anything more about these. So, then we have satellites that orbit the Earth in near exact polar orbits north to south. They cross the equator multiple times each day, and they are at the same angle with respect to the Sun. Satellites on these type of orbits are particularly useful for capturing images of Earth's surfaces and images of the Sun. So, as they go around, they take a picture of a building, so the shadow is always on the same side of the same building. And these are also used for the Iridium satellites. They also have a low Earth orbit, and they orbit around the pole, the North Pole, so North to South Pole. Those are basically, if you think of the way a cellular mobile network operates, those operate in a similar way, except that instead of you being in a train and being passed from one base station to the next base station, the base stations happen to be in the sky. And as you're talking, they move across the sky at quite high speeds, and then you switch from one to the next, which is why you get satellite communication over a radium phone is possible anywhere on the Earth. And it is also horrendously expensive. So there you go. That's that. Then the other type is medium Earth orbit. And that goes from 2,000 kilometers, 1,240 miles, to up to the where geosynchronous orbit is at, 35,786 kilometers, which is 22,236 miles. Now, you may ask yourself, well, the definition of low Earth orbit and medium Earth orbit all was like nice to 2,000 miles. Why suddenly have we got this weird, very specific, down to the last kilometer, down to the last mile thing? But before we go to that, let's talk to about medium Earth orbits. These are usually the ones over here are GPS, global positioning satellites, and they have an interesting thing is that they rotate around the Earth exactly two times a day. Every 12 hours they rotate around the Earth. So that is a feature that they make use of. So why this very specific band for what is the next category, which is geosynchronous orbits or geostationary orbits? So back in the 60s, this guy called Arthur C. Clarke came up with this idea that, you know, you have this area where you have the Iridium satellites are spinning, or let's say the International Space Station circles the Earth several times a day because it has to go so fast. It's constantly falling and its forward trajectory keeps it moving, and it falls in the same angle as the Earth. But if you go further out to the Moon, for instance, it is still horsing along at a mighty rate of knots. That's a technical term there for you. It's falling as well in respect to the Earth. And it is all, but it is revolving around the Earth at a interval of 30 days. So somewhere in between those two, the higher up you go, the less times you revolve the Earth, revolve around the Earth on a particular time. In order to maintain a particular orbit, you may need to maintain a particular speed. So if you go higher, then you need to maintain a slower, slightly slower speed, but you the number of times you revolve around the Earth decreases till such a point where it is you revolve around the Earth once a day. Okay, that's interesting. Why is that interesting, Ken? Everybody is going, please, we know this. Okay, anyway, it's interesting because from your point of view on Earth, you're revolving, and if you stick out your hand, and on your hand you're holding a satellite, and as you're revolving, the satellite is also falling at the same rate at which you're revolving. But if you look out there, it always seems to be in the same space in the sky, which is what makes it geostationary orbit, while it's geosynchronous. So the difference between a geostationary orbit and a geosynchronous orbit is a geostationary orbit is over the equator. And what that means is that as the Earth revolves around during the day, it still appears to be in the same spot, whereas geosynchronous and not geostationary means it can revolve up and down during the day. So it can, the angle of inclination is not necessarily the horizon. So as you look at it, it looks like the satellite is bouncing up and down during the day because the Earth is tilted, and as it rotates, the tilt of the Earth goes around. So from your point of view, the satellite is going down and then goes up, the same way that the sun goes up and down in the sky. It's due to the angle of rotation or angle of inclination of the Earth. For all you flat earthers out there, sorry, RIP Terry Pratchett, but turtles all the way down. So why would that be useful? Why would it going up and down be useful? Well, it turns out Japan has a geostationary satellite over there, which they're using for a global positioning system themselves. Well, it's not. It's a regional positioning system. And again, it changes twice in the one day. I have no idea if that actually has any significance or not, but it probably has. So people constantly are doing cool things with these orbits because they can. So for geostationary orbits, what that means is that Well, let's just take, if you want to communicate with any of the amateur radio satellites, which are out there, small, they operate in low Earth orbit, and they're usually sent up when they fill up the spaces, and they get sent out. They're tearing around the Earth, and they're basically falling. In order to pick them up, you need to track them with a beam, and you can track them as they go across the sky, and they go quite fast. The International Space Station also only appears, I think, for 10 minutes in the sky at any given time, and you have to track it from left to right. Imagine if you wanted to watch some TV, and the satellite only appears every few hours and only for 10 minutes at a time. That would be rather annoying for you. So for TV communications, it's very advantageous to have two things. One, a small dish that you don't need to point. And two, that your dish is fixed. So you put it up and you forget about it. So that's where geostationary satellites really come into their own. They're there, they're one point. The fact that they operate at the frequencies they operate, which I'm not going to get into, I'm not, this show will never end if I do, means that they have a higher bandwidth, but they're more susceptible to rain and cloud interference. But as it happens, it seems to work out okay. So the last classification with relate to altitude is anything above geosynchronous orbits is considered to be a high Earth orbit. There are a few more that I want to mention. The graveyard orbit is what happens when they have satellites that they don't want anymore. Instead of sending them back to Earth, which would cost fuel, they push them to a higher orbit. With the last remaining fuel, they push them out of the way. And basically, let's hope it doesn't come down. So, some other cool orbits, polar orbit, way of describing polar or orbits. Another one that I find interesting is polar orbits, which is used for Earth mapping, Earth observation, spying. Capturing Earth from time to time from one point, spying. And weather satellites. So the Iridium satellite constellation uses polar orbit to provide telecommunications services. The disadvantage of this orbit is that one spot on the Earth's surface can be sensed continuously from the satellite in the polar orbit. That no one point can be. But it does cover, or it can cover, all the areas of the Earth. So that's handy for weather. Now, I was telling you about advantageous of having a fixed dish pointing for TV. Now, say you had a that's fine. So that means it needs to be in geostationary or geostationary orbit on the equator. Well, that's fine, but the further north you go, the more you have to point your dish down. And the whole point of satellite communication is that it is designed to daisy chain signals from one place to the other. So you've got, I think in the Netherlands, there's a whole, the Netherlands being flat, for those of you who haven't done geography, is flat. And in order to communicate, the government during the Cold War built tall towers that were 300 meters high or so. And these towers independently communicated with each other, so that if anyone was taken out, then the rest would, the signals would carry through. And that works fine because they can see each other. But eventually you've got the curvature of the Earth comes into the play again. Again, sorry for the flat worlders. And you can't get a signal from one place to the other. In places that are not deprived of geography, like deprived of the third dimension, where they have mountains, your solution is to put the radio TV broadcast tower on the top of the mountains and broadcast to people. But sometimes people are in a valley or the other side of a hill, and they get very poor reception. Satellites solve this problem because with three satellites, you can theoretically broadcast to all places of the Earth. So signal going from one to the next, and you can also bounce signals off satellites themselves. So a satellite over Asia can see a satellite over Europe and can retransmit that to a satellite over the US and send the signal back down. So that's how live uplinks are quite often done. However, say you are the Soviet Union, and you've got some pretty cool guys who know how to put stuff into space, and you've got a lot of your population who are in the northern hemisphere up around Serbia, And so what are you going to do? Well, you come up with the Molnia orbit. Let me just play that for you.
Molnia.
One more time.
Molnia.
Molnia orbit, which means lightning in Russian. This is the coolest orbit ever. Now, I don't know if you've ever had those paddle games with an elastic band and a ball on it, and you go, and if you're good, you can do it against your face, and the ball goes out, and then it comes back, goes out, comes back. And if you do that over your right eye without hitting your right eye, on your left eye, you can still see the ball more or less stays in the same place. It gets bigger and smaller and bigger and smaller, but it more or less stays in the same place. Right, this is how this orbit works. You have three satellites. They're spinning around the Earth. They're not in an elliptical orbit around the center. They're spinning around in a highly orbit. So they come very close to the Earth on the way in, and they go very far away. They're caught by the gravity, and then they come back and they go speeding around, and then they go out again. So the journey out and the journey in are very the satellites appear in range for quite a long time. So as one is going out, the other one's coming back, and the third one is disappearing. Not only that, but the Earth is rotating as well, and they're with the wobble, they're picking up the satellite wobbles, and it is from the point of view of the satellite, it looks like the piece of land that it's aiming at is rotating, not with the rotation of the Earth, but rotating with the wobble. So it goes round like you would screw in a light bulb or something, round, over and back, over and back. There are some animations on this. It is, I think, one of the most underestimated achievements. That was how they were able to bring the Orbiter system online, which consisted of three highly elliptical Molnia satellites, Moscow-based ground uplink facilities, and 20 downlink stations located in cities and towns in the remote regions of Serbia and the Far East. Each station had 12-metre receiving parabolic antenna and transmitters for rebroadcasting TV signals to local households. That is absolutely awesome. So I've included a link to that as well. That's just my personal... You see how I get distracted with this, you know? This is why the show has not been done. That, and Murphy is very strong in this show. Everything that can go... I've tried to record this umpteen times down through the last 11 years. But anyway, yes, there's a nice two-scale SGV of orbital attitudes, and you can see on that where exactly all these orbits are, even from the point of view of Earth. Let me see, the medium Earth orbit, it would be about two or three sizes of the Earth away is where geosynchronous orbits are. And that's about a tenth of the way to the Moon, which is very far away, by the way, if you look at this diagram. Anyway, speaking of cool people with space technology, we can't talk about satellites, so we've done orbits, satellites now, without talking about Sputnik 1, which was the very first artificial satellite, Soviet Union, and this is coming from Wikipedia page, so all the opinions are from here. The Soviet Union, struggling not to do a Russian accent, launched it on an elliptical low Earth orbit on October the 4th, 1957. It was 58 centimetres, 23 inches diameter, polished metal sphere with four external radio antennae to broadcast radio pulses. It was visible all around the Earth, and the radio pulses were detectable. This surprise success precipitated the American Sputnik crisis and triggered the space race, a part of the larger Cold War. The launch ushered in new political, military, technological and scientific developments. So, yes. Okay, what makes up the components of a satellite? I was actually, this is one of the things when we had an internal class when I worked at that satellite company. And it was one of the most interesting classes that we had about, you know, what issues you have with a satellite getting it into space. And I have not been able to get a copy of that presentation. The guy wanted to give it to me, but couldn't find it anymore. and also getting information on the actual components of a satellite, you go from extremely simplified to no, we're not kind of sharing that information with you. But basically, a typical satellite will, well, communication satellite here, I have no idea what other satellites have. They have rocket motors to maneuver left, right, and up and down every so often. You try and then you have fuel tanks, solar panels, batteries, onboard computer, and antennas, transceivers, or transponders. What determines the lifespan of a satellite is not the technology on board, because there will always be somebody, when they launch a satellite, they always try and put as much new technology into it, the best compression or the best transponders, densest. They've got lots of tricks for getting an optimal footprint and all that sort of thing. But at a particular point in time, they need to keep the satellites in a particular box. So you go to the ITCU, and I've got a picture from the Boeing commercial satellite. Boeing commercial communication satellite geosynchronous Orbis, and it gives you all the allocated satellites from the ITCU and where they are. So each of them are given a slot, and some of those slots are incredibly desirable, overpopulated areas, and then you have other places like in the middle of the Pacific where there's nothing, no satellites at all. That's not to say that those positions are not used, but you have no satellites at all over there, because you put the satellites where you are going to have them, be able to use them. So, for example, here we have satellites 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 4 degrees, 5 degrees, 7 degrees apart. So, you know, a degree or something like that. Once you get a slot, you are required to operate in a box, which is 18 kilometers by 18 kilometers by 18 kilometers. Well, not by 18 kilometers, but a box of 18 kilometers by 18 kilometers. And these orbits are not pure, they're elliptical, as in they come in and go out from Earth about 300 kilometers, depending. So that's pretty much okay. But the position east and west is important for an operator to keep their satellites there, because the fixed antenna are there, and you don't want to be moving, drifting your satellite. So satellite drift is a big thing. Your satellite drifts into your neighboring slot, and then suddenly somebody who expects to have an Arabic channel is suddenly getting a Hindi channel or something. So you're required to keep it into a box. The more stable, in order to do that, if it starts drifting, so it hits particles and stuff that affects it, or there's an earthquake on Earth which suddenly turns the Earth around a smidgen, then all the satellites need to be readjusted to account for that. And so the satellites are in this box thing, as they call it, and in order to keep them in there, they need to fire rockets to keep them orientated correctly. Those rockets require fuel, and the cost of refueling a satellite is more expensive than it would be to put a new satellite up, which has got newer stuff and newer kit. So the worth of a satellite is based on A, its position, B, how much fuel it's got on board. And when they launch a satellite, they'll launch it in a low Earth or in medium Earth, low medium Earth orbit. And then they will fire the onboard, make sure everything's okay. Then they'll fire it, send it into an orbit, an elliptical orbit that sends it in to the Earth and out further until it gets to geosynchronous orbit. Then they'll burn some fuel to keep it into a geosynchronous orbit. What they will usually do is park them for a while somewhere over the Pacific or somewhere, so they can test them. And basically, it's just hovering over the Pacific. And then when they want to move it into position, what they'll do is they'll slow it down. They'll fire a little bit of fuel. They'll slow it down so that it passes slowly the Earth. It's revolving slightly less fast than the Earth is. And then it will catch up its position. They'll fire the rocket again, speed it up, bump it up that little bit, slow it down. So they slow it down that little bit, bump it up that little bit. Everything everything is based in conservation of fuel, because the more fuel that you can save, the more money you can make from your satellite. And once your satellite is no longer, you're no longer able to keep it into the 18 kilometer box for geosynchronous stuff, you'll send it off somewhere else to another orbit where it doesn't, where they've got a lot more free space on both sides. So where it needs a larger antenna to receive it. And then as it loses fuel on the 18 kilometer box, then in order to track it, you would need to have a moving satellite dish. So that brings it maybe into that mightn't be so useful for end-to-end customers, but as a business, if you're operating on an oil rig, then you might take some transponders on one of those satellites and have your moving antenna follow this satellite, so you'll be able to get a lot of bandwidth to your oil rig for a very cheap price. So that a lot of that trading goes on, just so you know. So other components of, but basically what a satellite is. So we got solar panels. So 40 meter once it goes out into space, the solar panels come out, and they are 40 meter panels, and they charge batteries, and the batteries charge the computer, the onboard electronics, which probably is computers, and they keep the whole thing going. Now you have several people might be broadcasting to a particular satellite. And what a satellite is like a huge, tall radio tower that's in the sky. It takes in signals from one place and it sends them out on the other. And I've put a link in the show notes that has got more technical breakdown on how transponders work. So let me just... So the word transponder is derived from the word transmitter and responder. A communication satellite transponder is a series of interconnected units that form a communication channel between the receiving and the transmitting antenna. It's mainly used in satellite communications to transfer the received signals. A transponder consists of an input limiting device, a low pass filter, an input low noise amplifier, LNA, designed to amplify the normally very weak, because of the large distances involved, signals received from the Earth station. A frequency translator, normally composed of an oscillator and a frequency mixer, used to convert the frequency of the received signal to the frequency required for the transmitted signal. And then an output bypass filter and a power amplifier. This can be a traveling wave tube or a solid state amplifier. And for more information on that, see the link that I put into the show notes. You basically received a signal in on a particular frequency, and then that's down on from the uplink, and that's downlinked on another frequency. So what satellite operators will do is they'll have the most of the Astra fleet, and quite a lot of the SES Astra fleet is managed by SES Astra, which are in Luxembourg. And I was lucky enough to have a site visit there one time, which is pretty impressive. And they control the physical location of the satellites, you know, where it is in the box and stuff, and when they need to do a burn and when they don't need to do a burn. And they will allocate, to say, to the BBC or FreeSat, which we're going to be talking about now, which is a broadcaster. So it's free-to-air satellite communications for the UK. So they will allocate certain transponders and frequency codes for them, and they will broadcast the uplink on those frequencies, and then on their website they will publish, here are their receiving frequencies for these transponders. So you will buy a transponder or several transponders, and then it's up to you to divvy it up. So if you use an analog TV, you're going to may be able to get four channels in there. If you use an MPEG-2, you might be able to get eight. MPEG-4, you might be able to get 16. So that's why all those technologies are quite interesting from a broadcast point of view. But the same number of bits going through the satellite is quite important. From a data point of view, when you're sending data through, One of the main issues they have with satellites is, as well as the fuel, is the thermal issues that they have. It goes from 100 and something degrees Celsius, 150 degrees Celsius, to minus 150 degrees during the rotation of the thing, and that's very stressful on the satellite itself. But what they've noticed as well was when they were sending data through. Mostly when you're not transmitting, or there was an exceptional bias to zeros. And of course, zeros means you're not transmitting anything. So if you're not transmitting anything, things get cold. And once you start sending ones, things get hot. So you had this massive thermal, the satellites were not lasting as long as they thought they would because of the thermal impact of going from, you know, a quiet time in the evening, when it's nighttime, to suddenly boom, you're on during the day. They never accounted for that. So now built into the DVB specification, DVB-S specification, between the uplink and the satellites, and of course the downlink, they have an algorithm put in there so that they're always transmitting bytes, sort of semi-randomly, that there will always be a more or less equal number of ones and an equal number of zeros. So they've built that into the whole system. Another cool thing they do is that it's polarized, so a low noise black. So they will have a big tracking station to transmit up in the microwave KU band, which you can look this up as well, what that actually means in gigahertz. And then it'll be sent down to your receiver. Your receiver is a parabolic dish, you know, shaped like a plate or a bowl, and that focuses the beams in to a particular point. And at that point, you have a low noise block down device, which takes the high frequency signals and converts them into lower frequencies that can be sent over a short coaxial cable. Oh gosh, I've said that about 15,000 times for recording this show. But anyway, that's what it does. And then you can bring that into your house and into your satellite equipment. And again, later on, we'll do. I'll go up on the roof and I'll actually do the pointing of the dish. So one of the cool things they do there, though, is they also use the fact that you can polarize a signal. You can have a horizontal and vertical. Now, as far as I know, it's not actually horizontal vertical. It's more like a spiral helix that goes down. But I will leave that up to one of the ham radio enthusiasts to talk to us about that. So that is basically how satellites operate. And then it comes into a receiving device. The signal comes into a set-top box. You can also have USB ones. I've got one here. I've got old PCI cards that you can use, or a regular satellite receiving box if you just want to receive TV. Receiving, listening onto a satellite, if you're into this sort of thing, is really cool because a lot of the stuff is not encrypted, and even you can see the packets going past, and it's just interesting from a understanding a DVB protocol, putting a Wireshark on there, and you can see like people, you know, what people are doing if they're surfing the internet and that sort of thing. I think a lot of that is now encrypted end-to-end, so there's a lot less of that going on. But back in the day, it was before Wi-Fi, open Wi-Fi points were available, it was just mind-blowing to be able to see all the stuff that people were watching and using the services for. So that goes into the pointing a satellite dish. So we will talk about that outside, and I've got a link to the dish pointer site and a printout of what I'm just going to use now in a minute to point the dish. I'm going to be going to the Astra 28.2 East, or Eurohotbird fleet of satellites, which is the FreeSat ones, and there's a list of those. They're co-located, so there was SES Astra operates the Astra 2E, 2F and 2G satellites from there. The drop down box shows that 2A, 2C, 2D and 2F were operating at that time. So 2D and 2A. 2A has been decommissioned, so it's been moved up to a graveyard one. And 2C has been sold on to somebody else and they get renamed. So when you hear about new satellite launch, new satellite for blah, 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 blah service, means it could be some other satellite that's end of life for somebody else. I've also linked in a pretty cool page on how to get MIT TV working with DVB-S, so FreeSat HD. What hardware you need, AppGate update, install DVB apps and mPlayer, and then you just scan user share DVB, DVB-S, Astra 2E, which has got all the information you need, into your channels.conf file. If you've done any DVB stuff at all, this is very, very similar. So that's all pretty cool, and you can then start watching TV, or you can start doing ISP stuff. So people who are using satellite internet might want to record us a little show and see how that goes. So some other things we're going to need for part of this is the azimuth, which is the distance from north, altitude, or in our thing it's elevation, which is the distance from the equator up. And let me just pause this right now. I really don't believe this. This is now the third time I've had to record this. The first time, the batteries ran out. The second time, I had the double record Zoom H2 bug. Right, I don't have a choice but to continue recording this, because this show has to be released and there's no way to stop it. The day I picked happens to be the most windy day in when I just step out here. There's happens to be a force nine gale going on at the minute, and two of my panels have already fallen down. The neighbour's roof has come off and they've got sandbags up there to stop the roof falling off. So anyway, what we're here to explain to you is how the ins and outs of pointing a satellite dish. It's not something that I ever was that particularly good at, mostly because there's three things involved. You need to get the location of the satellite east and west, where it's located. You need to point based on elevation, and then you need to adjust for a polarization. Well, I'll try and put on a sound thing. Just one second. I'm standing here. It's absolutely freezing cold up here. I've been up here for an hour and a half. And before I go, I need to remember to clean out that gutter. Half of my flat roof is dry, the other half has got an inch of water on it, where it's clogged up with leaves and stuff. Anyway, I'm still recording, okay, fine. Anyway, a satellite dish is actually quite reasonably cheap. You can buy a card for 28 euros or so for a cheap USB satellite card. Devices, you can buy a whole kit including the satellite dish and stand and the receiver for 150 euros, dollars, you know, in the ballpark, sub 200 euros, you'll have yourself a good kit. And there's a lot of reasons to get that, like FreeSat in the UK, we're just in the boundary of FreeSat here, and you can get a lot of UK and Irish programming free to air. So the three things that you need to know about when pointing a satellite, we've already covered. Elevation, azimuth, which is how much left and right, basically. Elevation is how much up and down. And the last thing is the skew. Now, back in the day, if you are pointing a satellite dish, the best thing to do is get your stand correct. If you're using a portable stand, if you put it on a level surface, you're good. If you're attaching it to the wall, make sure it's 100% vertical in all directions. That will make your life an awful lot easier. So that will get that out of the way. I have a satellite finder which connects between the LNB, which is the low noise block down device, or low noise block, they always called it, but anyway, It's the thing for converting microwave signals down into the range that can be carried across a coaxial cable. Now, your coaxial cable will connect with it's a sort of higher quality cable, I think 75 ohms, the impedance, and it has got, I'm not 100% sure about that, and it's got an F-type connector, so that's like a screw-in connector on it. So that's, you'll have a little cable go into the satellite finder, and the satellite finder then will go to the sat box or some other device to give it power. It needs a certain number of volts in order to operate, which you'll find anyway. The first thing you do is you find out, you need to know where you are, so you need to refer to the footprint, satellite footprint, and on the satellite footprint is basically a map of the world, or the footprint of the satellite. So it's a map of a geographic region, so Europe, North America, Africa, Middle East, Africa, wherever, Asia, I guess. And in there you will see like contour rings, and in these particular rings it'll tell you where you are and what you need to calculate out, what your azimuth is, elevation, and that sort of thing, depending on where you are. And you can go to the website and they will have like documents showing all of this. Then you adjust your azimuth, which is, you find out where south is, which is the opposite of north, and then you move your dish either east or west, depending on which way you want to go, and then you pick the satellites, and then you adjust the azimuth, which are the elevation, which is up and down, and then you adjust the skew of the LMB. I have no idea if I've said this before, because I've already said it three times before anyway. So, I don't tend to use a satellite finder so much, because it's an analog device and it doesn't really tell you a lot of information. It is also quite difficult, depending on the satellite you're trying to tune to. The one that we were using was next in the slot to the east of the Astra satellites, so the 2A, 2C, 2D and 2F, although 2A has been decommissioned and 2G is up there now replacing it, 28.2 east, and it was very difficult to point that, because you were blasted with each of these satellites and all their signals coming down. So they, Astra, co-located all their satellites in this 18 kilometer box, so that each of them transmitted at a different frequencies in that area. So from the point of view of your dish, it looked like one big transmission, so you're switching physically from one satellite to the next satellite to the next satellite to the next satellite, but you don't have to move your dish, because they're all located in that 18 kilometer block, which sounds like a massive space difference, but you know, we're talking about how far away is it? We're talking about 20-30 nearly 40,000 kilometers away. So yeah, 18 kilometers in there is not a lot, and those, it's not a perfectly circular course either that those satellites have. They come in and out 300 kilometers, I think, in the rotation of a day. But anyway, that's by the by. I'm now completely, oh, wind's picking up. Okay, you move in here again. Getting distracted. Anyway, yes, dish is pointing. So the actual easiest thing to do now when you want to point a satellite dish is you get a kit. It's reasonably cheap, or you can get them secondhand. And you go to Satellite Finder website, you put in your town, village, latitude, longitude, where you are, and that will bring up a Google Maps aerial photo, and you can move the satellite icon to where you want to put your satellite dish, and then you select from the drop-down list one of the satellites that you want to tune to, and that'll give you all the lovely information down below. So elevation, in my case, I need to be 26.5 degrees from the horizontal. Azimuth true is 151.7, so if I knew exactly where south was, and azimuth magnetic, says 150.9. So when I'm going with a compass, that's the hunky-dory. So that would be nice information as well. But another thing they do is draw a line over the Google Maps thing. And this line happens to intersect the hotel sign that's down at the train station. So all I've had to do has been hold on to the edge of the satellite dish and move it left and right, until I find that it's more or less pointing at that thing. Now, one cool thing about the... So I'm not using the satellite finder. What I'm doing is putting it into the set-top box receiver, which was connected to a portable TV. And most of these devices, set-top box receivers, have got a satellite finding mode where they'll give you the power and signal quality. And my one actually is able to name the satellite that you're pointing to, which is actually awesome, because that tells you, oops, well, I'm pointing at Astra 2 whatever, and I want to point to another satellite. Well, there are three slots to the west of that, so let's move, at least I'm too much left rather than too much right, if you get the idea. So once you have that done, first thing you should do is try and find the azimuth. If you can get that done, you're hunky-dory, because you know that north and south of that, you're not going to be any other satellites. It's just east and west the satellites are located. So try and get that, and if your device is able to tell you which satellite you're locked onto, you're absolutely golden. The satellite dish itself is connected to the mount, so in my case it's a stand, as I said, with some concrete garden tiles holding it down on a flat roof which points south. So once you get that, I've got there's like lug clips that hold on the clamp. So once the clamp is fixed, the clamp holds onto the satellite dish, and it's curved. And the curve it's got a curved male groove that goes into a female groove on the back of the satellite dish, and that's got it's basically like a compass, and it's in there got the degrees of elevation, so that allows you to roughly guess where the elevation is. In my case, the numbers printed on that bear absolutely no resemblance to what it says here in this document, 26.5 degrees, and the thing actually says 19 degrees. So well done there, but that's where your satellite finder power display will help you out, power and signal quality, because once you get that right, you know it doesn't actually matter if you've got wherever you happen to get the highest amount of signal strength, you're absolutely golden. I remember trying to point a satellite dish for a demo, and during the demo it was completely blocked, we could not see south, and then one of the guys had a smart idea, well, let's point to the building in the north, which was a modern glass building, and there's enough satellite signal was being rebounded off that building that we could point our satellite dish more or less north and still be able to pick up a reception. It was an absolutely awesome demo. You got your thingy, you got your elevation, and now the only thing that you need to do is work out on skew. So that is, again, don't really look too much at the numbers, look at the output from your satellite receiver and just move it horizontally. So if you were pointing the satellite dish, if the satellite was like directly south, your skew would be zero. But the more east and west that your satellite goes, then you need to adjust the skew to adjust for what would be horizontal in pointing at that satellite. Now, the reason they do this, I don't know if I've said this before, but if I did, anyway. The reason for that is that you, to increase the bandwidth, they send a horizontal and vertical polarization. So, when this was explained to me at ham radio school, ham radio class, it's a rotating signal that comes through in the polarization. But what it actually means is that one of the signals can be kept fairly well apart from the other signal, so you can basically double your satellite capacity. Okay, once that is done, what I suggest you do is tighten everything up. Keep an eye on your signal, because as you're tightening it up, do like a good drummer, adjust the opposite sides equally. So one turn on the left, one turn on the right, one turn on the left, one turn on the right. That will keep it nice and tight and in tune and not moving around. Keep an eye on your satellite settings, and that you're getting maximum power, maximum signal strength. I advise not to do this if you're working on a high building like I am, when there's a lot of wind going on, although it seems to have quietened down now again. And keep an eye on your signal, tighten everything up. And then one last tip is always make sure to just as I say that, it's a big gust of wind coming nearly. I'm grand. Just get a piece of a nail or something and just scrape in the lines on your setup, because that way then you're not going to on your setups, that if anything moves, like this wind basically moves the satellite dish out of the way, that you'll be able to readjust everything rather quickly. Now, just so that is pretty much that. Now, before I go down, I'm just going to go over here and clear out some leaves. Ooh, it's a bit slippy.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.